Yes, as a very young child, because we lived on the seafront, and we had a door that went from the front garden down onto the promenade. I used to escape from the garden, wander down the promenade, and particularly in the summer, wander along to the King's Statue where they had Punch and Judy. And my mum knew when I was 4, 5, and 6 that if I wasn't at home, she'd send one of the, because we were one of 5 children, and she'd send one of the other children down to find me at the Punch and Judy and bring me home. And so I had many happy hours just sitting on the seafront
Really?
watching. I knew the Punch and Judy off by heart, you know? And that was really enjoyable.
Okay,
That was probably
and they knew you then by then, really. I expect you
the
probably
Punch and
spoke.
Judy man knew me well, yes. And he frequently, you know, if my sister went up and said, "Oh, where's Nick?" And, "Oh, he's over there." You know? So that was great fun. That was probably my earliest memory
Okay.
of Wayne the seafront.
Yeah,
And
yeah.
there were donkeys and various other things down there, and sat there. The man was still carving the sand, and that always fascinated me. So
Okay, so for what we're talking about, four, yeah,
that'd
just
be
40, 49, 50.
49, 50, 51, something like that.
Okay. So that's quite a thought, really, if I think for thinking of young mothers today, that a 5-year-old is off wandering down a busy from on their own.
Yes, but then there was a lost children's hut on the seafront because lots of children wandered around and got lost, and in those days it was accepted that children got lost and someone would take them. You know, if you found a child, as I understand it, you'd be taken to the lost children's hut and no one would question somebody coming along other than that they were trying to help get a child back to his parents. So,
Well, I suppose, and it's true. I suppose there is that lost children's hut
is there?
on
I didn't know that.
the,
But certainly, you know, you'd have no hesitation if you saw a child wandering about. Someone would frequently come up and take your hand, and the child wouldn't worry about it and would know that he was being taken to the lost children's hut, not immediately think something awful was about to happen. So I think there is probably a change in perception there, yes.
Well, there is, I think, approaching young children, I
Yes.
think, for adults. Okay, so living on the Esplanade on the beach, I suppose summertime is the burning thing that always sticks in my mind for Weymouth.
Yes, I'm pale-skinned and I burnt easily indeed. I'm still having to pay the penalty for that. And I frequently had all the skin sort of burnt off my back and thought it was fun laying in the sun, but realised afterwards it was very painful. And you learnt to swim fairly early on, and I learnt to sail very early on. But I used to swim out to the rafts, and the rafts were quite an adventure because it was quite a long distance where you couldn't touch the bottom between. I think the raft was only in about 5 foot of water because adults could stand up out there, but the children couldn't, and you'd have to do that desperate stretch of 100 feet or something, rather knowing that you couldn't stop and you had to get there, and that was really quite exciting.
Yeah, well, when the tide's in, it can be quite a way for a
Yes,
young.
but we were down at the pier bandstand end of the swimming area, so we had a better, or an easier route out to the raft than you did further along towards Malcolm Avenue. No, but the beach was just about everything for leisure. We used to go for walks along to Bowleys and round to Osmington with my mum and dad, and we had a dog. Indeed, we found the dog at Bowleys. We found a dog wandering around and brought him home and told the police, and they said, "Well, you know, he's yours unless anyone claims him," and no one claimed him, so our first dog arrived from one of these walks.
Okay. So when you walked to Bowleys then, so you walked from Bowleys from your house,
Yes.
you didn't have that Esplanade walk.
You walked along the top of the wall. There was a protective wall and a shingle beach, and there was still a lot of the concrete blocks from the war that had been put all the way along there to stop, I presume, to stop ships or tanks or something rather coming ashore. So the concrete blocks were all in the shingle, and it was a pleasant walk along there. There was absolutely no development to the left. If you look, the Sea Life Centre and all that was not there, and the gardens at the end were very mysterious. The corner that's now sort of huts and gardens and sand, that was there was a sluice gate there, and if you went down into the little area of water between the sluice gate and the sea, there were lots of eels. So we used to go along with nets and try and catch the eels in there, but it was very overgrown. The water was quite deep when the sluice was shut, and the parents banned us completely from going in there. But certainly in the period I was down at Greenhill, I remember wandering along there. And as we left Green Hill, probably when I was about eight, this must be before I was eight, I was wandering along collecting eels in the sluices along there.
And what did you do with your eels? You take them
You home? Let them go again. No, okay. No. They're very, very hard to hold on to, eels. Mm. So it was great fun to get them in the net, but then equally good fun to try and get them out of the net and back into the water again.
put them down a friend's jumper.
Yes, less so, because they were impossible to hold on to. So if you caught hold of them, they just shoot out of your hand and slither off in the grass somewhere.
You'd take them home to your mother and say, look, can we have this for dinner?
No, we didn't do that. Although they used to catch sprats along there. So a man in a boat, and frequently it happened on a Sunday, and I think that was when we got involved. A man would take a rowing boat out to sea with a net towed behind, and the other man would stand on the beach holding one end of it, and he'd go around in a great big circle. And then all the children and any adults passing or anything else would help pull it in. And if you had a bucket, he'd give you a bucket of sprats in return for helping pull in the net. But of course, the nets would be absolutely full of sprats. So I don't remember when this was, but I do remember going along, coming home with a bucket of sprats and saying to Mum, tea for the next week or something. She loves sprats.
That's nice, because I have seen that. I remember seeing that in Portugal, and it's like, say, that custom of the boats going out and the nets and pulling them in.
Yeah. And it was wonderful, because you'd watch the net coming in closer and closer and closer, and you'd see nothing in it, and you'd think, oh, it's a complete waste of time, but it's jolly heavy. And then all of a sudden, a sort of big sack at the end came in, and there'd be a lorry. Well, they used to bring a sort of van thing down onto the prom, and they'd haul the nets up and scoop it all up into bins and take it up and put it in the back of this van.
All right, that's quite nice. Yeah, I'm just trying to think, because I lived at Green Hill. What you're talking about, that experience, is very similar to mine, but obviously mine was 74, 76.
Right.
And I'm just thinking that those beach huts were there, and Lodmore Country Park, was all built up.
That wasn't there when I was young. Lodmore was an absolute wilderness. You didn't dare go into it, really. There was one halfway along the beach was Shorey's cottage, which was a cottage occupied by a very dodgy old man. The house had nothing had been done to the house for years, and you stayed well clear of him, because he was a character.
Okay.
Shall I tell you this? Because Sugarham Shorey used to call him, because he had a horse and cart, and I suspect his only income, but I have no idea now. This is how it was perceived when I was, certainly under 10. He'd come into Weymouth with his horse and cart and deliver logs to people. And if you shouted Sugarham Shorey at him, he'd stand up on his cart and heave the nearest piece of wood that he could find at you. And very rarely hit, but he was a nice old man, I'm sure, although I never got close enough to talk to him.
No, it's one of those sort of like scary men that all the boys sort of like were a bit wary of.
But yes, we all knew that if you shouted Sugarham Shorey at him, he'd get really upset and come chasing after you, and poor old horse would be put under a bit of pressure.
So that was halfway
along the beach road. There's still the sluice there, but it's now just a ringed in. I think it's all automated now. If it works at all, I don't know. But it was when there was heavy flooding. They wanted to keep the marshes, and I think they could let seawater in if they wanted to, or they could let fresh water out if they wanted to. It's principally, I think, to let fresh water out.
Right.
But of course, you could only let it out at low tide. So they'd wait till the tide went out, and then they'd open the sluices and let a whole lot of water out.
Okay.
And then as the tide started to come in to stop the seawater coming back into the marsh, that's my understanding of it, they'd shut it.
Yeah.
And so they kept the marshes fresh water.
Yeah.
No, but there was one house on the hill. If you look across where all those houses are all over the hill on the shore side, there was one big white house. And if you look at old naval charts, there was White House conspic up on there. And certainly later when we were sailing, you had to. When I started, you could see the white house because it was very conspicuous.
On the hill at Preston? The
sort of square one, yes. And if you look in amongst the housing estate, there's one square white house. Well, that used to be the only house there. And so much so that it was on naval charts as conspicuous white house. And then later, when I was sailing in my teens, you'd look at this vast collection of houses and one house down the middle of it. So that changed as well.
Oh, so you're right, yeah. So they all got built then in that period when you're growing up.
And as you got to the end at Preston, the Coast Guard cottages ran right along there and out long after where they are now. And a large part of the sea and quite a few of the Coast Guard cottages have fallen down into the sea. So it was quite fun walking up over the golf links. Even then, the golf links had cracks in where it was clearly going to. But they were playing golf up on the top. I think it's just a field now.
Mm.
But there was a sort of 9-hole golf course, I think, up on the seaside of the road to Bowley's.
Yeah, there used to be like a putting green type.
Well, it got smaller and smaller and smaller all the time. But it was quite big. As a child, I remember it being very large. And every year I go back, it gets smaller and smaller and more. It falls into the sea.
Okay, yeah, not much, I don't think. Anyway, but Bowley's was not there at all then, really?
The embassy, the big... As you went over the hill, there was the pub on the right, that was always there just past the Coast Guard cottages. And as a teenager, I remember you could go and take the empty bottles, because in those days there was a return charge on a bottle, and you could take the empty bottles from their return shed and take them inside and get your money back and get a drink. So if you wanted a drink for nothing, you could do it that way. But if you went over the hill, there were some nice houses on the left, and the Roman villa on the left. And then at the bottom, there was the farm on the left. None of the amusement park was there, but the hotel was there. And there was a landing stage, and the paddle steamers used to go in.
Oh, right.
And so there was a long landing stage that they rolled out on wheels. The same as the white boats down at by the pier bandstand. In the old days, they had a landing stage they rolled out into the sea there. And the paddle steamer, I think it was the Consul, I can't remember. The embassy and the Consul, I think, were the two paddle steamers' names, cousins and co-boats. And they used to go in there. It was really quite exciting to watch them coming in and passengers getting off and going down this landing stage and presumably having tea at Bowley's or something or other. But it was... Remember that.
Mm. Okay. So in sailing, so you mentioned sailing. So you...
So I went to Hardy's when I was 11. We'd moved then, we were in Dorchester Road, 26 Dorchester Road, which is just past what used to be the training college, and it may still be the training college.
Mm.
We'd rented the house in on Green Hill from a reverend who owned the big block of houses, Reverend Belden, and we swapped with an aunt who lived at 26 Dorchester Road, so we bought her house and she moved into a flat. She and her husband were getting more elderly, and it was a lovely house, and I went off to Hardy's in Dorchester. Sorry, I've forgotten your question there.
That's okay. We're talking. Yeah, you mentioned sailing. I suppose you have.
Oh yes, when I got to Hardy's, they had a sailing club, and we built a boat, an Enterprise. Built two boats in the woodwork, and they came in kits, I think, and we only put them together, but it was still great fun, and went sailing one day a week. And Dad bought me a little boat as well. It cost £100 in those days, but Cygnus and Enterprise. I joined Weymouth Sailing Club because Mum thought it would, I think, I'd meet a more appropriate group of friends than I was making. I used to go down to the amusement park on the backwater, and I think she was quite nervous of some of the friends I'd made, so she decided that the sailing club might get me more interested in a group of friends who are less likely to lead me astray.
And what's the backwater?
The Swanery. On the Swanery, if you went over the bridge, Chipperfields had a virtually permanent... It was an amusement arcade on the far side. No, it wasn't an amusement arcade. It was an amusement park. But it was rather like the fair that went to Portland, but it was a permanent installation there. And...
Because there wouldn't be all those amusement arcades on the seafront then.
I used to go in there as well, yes, but they I think there weren't nearly as many as there are now. There was certainly one. It was the park with, because that had dodgems and all sorts of. I was much more interested in dodgems and rides, and it was much more active than sticking. The only things in the amusement arcades in those days were things where you had tried to get the balls to land in a series of troughs at the top. Mm. And if you went to the milk, we used to go and drink coffee and tea in the milk bars. There are a couple in the town, certainly one, maybe two. And that always had a jukebox, which was fun because you'd listen to all the latest records. And
okay, so you're becoming onto teenager then, really. But we'll come on to that. But yeah, come. So sailing. So you built a boat.
Yes.
Sounds quite impressive, really.
We must have. I remember you could sail during the day. We built two boats at school, and I bought the boat. Cygnus was my first E3968, so I'm
And
now
were
on
they
a
like a
200 pound or something.
two-man boat or four?
Well, you could sail it on your own, but you it was more fun with two people, and frequently we'd go sailing in the morning before we went to school, and you could from Dorchester Road knit round. So you could leave it on the beach quite safely in those days. Just pull it up on the beach and leave it, and take it out in the morning and go for a sail for an hour, and come back and leave it and go to school all day and come back and it'd still be there and no one would have pinched things, you
Oh, right,
know.
okay.
No, it's fun.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, because that was it. Because when you say sail it, because you think that's it, you have to go round to the harbour, unlock the gates, get it all out.
You had to do that. Obviously, put it away for if you were, but if you just wanted to go out 2 days running, perhaps over the weekend, you'd drag it up on the beach. You'd take away your life jackets and things like that, but you'd be quite happy to leave a boat with its sails and all its gear down there. And we never had anything stolen off it, so.
All right. So, what do you? What, I mean, so the beach. Were there any signs of the war then still on the beach?
Other than these concrete blocks, none. No, they'd all been cleared away. But there were. I remember as a child, we used to play on bomb sites. If you came over the town bridge to the right, where I think it's now the council offices, or certainly going along to the fire station, that area had been flattened. I think a mine, an aerial mine or something that they used to use,
Oh,
had
okay.
blown up and flattened that area.
Oh.
And there were still the sort of half walls of buildings all the way along there. And there were lots of plants had grown up in walls and things. It was, you know, it's. I suppose 7 or 8 years since it had happened, so they cleared away most of the dangerous stuff. But it was still fun because you could find all sorts of odd bits and pieces in there, and you could play chase and hide and seek and so on. And no one seemed to mind you doing that.
I was going to ask then, yeah, was it, yeah, were you allowed in there to play?
You weren't allowed in. You'd
But
get a
no.
clipped ear from the policeman if he caught you, but
Oh.
you know, the police didn't chase you too significantly. You know, there was Bobby'd be on a bike and shout at you, but. He wouldn't bother to cycle after you. Once he'd seen you'd seen it and were moving out, then. So he knew you weren't meant to be in there, but it wouldn't have been fun if you were meant to be there.
Yeah,
So.
right.
And we used to go in the Grand Hotel as it is now. That was all empty. I don't. I think it had been used by services during the war. Do you remember the Grand Hotel? Yeah. Well, that had a great big. Can't remember what. I think it was bay hedge all the way along the seafront. And you could, as a child, easily get through the hedge. There were no real defences. The doors were all unlocked and open, and birds were sort of flying around inside it. It was a semi-derelict building,
Oh, fantastic.
and that was great fun as well because you could imagine the sort of grandeur of the place inside. And it was dry and warm, so on a rainy day, it was quite fun to go and, you know, play games in the Grand Hotel. It wasn't called the Grand Hotel; it was just an empty house as far as we were concerned. But it was a very nice empty house. Good
Yeah,
fun.
no, that's fantastic, yeah.
But those were sort of odd bits from the war. There were quite a few, there were a lot more houses that were empty. Presumably people had been killed and not come back, or I don't know, but there were houses that were empty in various places in the town that you could get into. They were uncared for, I suppose is the right word, and
Okay,
people
so
had actually fallen down.
wonder like sort of wonder if they've been commandeered by the army and not
Well, certainly,
not by
yes, I think they.
because the pavilion wasn't commandeered but wasn't it by the I think the American I think they used it for a base.
Yes. We were taken. Well, I went to Thornlow School, and halfway through the afternoon one day, we were all told, right, get your coats on, and we were taken down to watch the pavilion burn down. The fire had started, and it was seen as sort of sufficiently momentous that the school children would be taken down to show what happens if you play with fire, I think. So we all wandered down there and watched the.
Oh, that's
That was
fantastic.
amazing. It was quite an experience. Biggest fire I've ever seen.
And like, well, big crowd as well,
Oh,
really.
very big
People
crowd
like,
of
you know,
people
the whole
watching it.
town would
The whole
turn.
town turned out to watch the firemen battling with it. It was painfully obvious they weren't going to win because by the time we got down, you know, it was half gutted anyway.
I know.
Momentous experience.
Well, no, I know, and it's like sort of like such a different, you know, sort of pavilion that would be sorely sought after nowadays that they
It
had
wasn't
there.
the pavilion, was it? Was it
Oh, the
the
Ritz,
Ritz?
yeah.
Yes, and it was a very elegant building with lots of.
Victorian, yeah, so like yeah, very wooden, which is why it'd gone up so much.
Yes.
Oh, that's fantastic. Oh no, because I
So.
did a film a few years ago with some children in Weymouth about the back, the it burning down. So yeah, it's one of the things.
Yeah.
I remember a few people, like say, going up all around Weymouth on the Hills, actually, wasn't just the town, just went, yeah, to watch.
It was a stunning fire. I mean, terrible end to a building, but pretty stunning fire.
Yeah, that was it. Because they were redecorating it after the army had sort of like left it, you know, in quite a battered state.
Yeah.
And they were sort of like tarting it up a bit.
Someone said it was a blow lamp. That was the story that went around the town. Yeah.
Yeah, that was a sort of official thing that they seemed to say it was.
Yeah. What else did we do? Oh, we used to, the train ran around the town. That was very exciting because the old good passenger train took people to and from the pier by the Ritz to the ferries. And if you took a big old penny, mind you, it was, big old penny was worth a lot of money, so you didn't do this very often, but if you put a big old penny on the rails and watched the train rumble over it, by the time it had gone past, you had a penny that was about twice the size, you know. So we flattened a lot of pennies, I remember, in the course of our early days on the, it was fascinating to watch it getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And we used to watch, we purported to help, but I'm sure they did it on their own, but they had to move cars that had parked near the train, and it was quite fun to go down there and just push cars, thinking you were helping get them out of the way. And I used to go to the bottom of Coombe Valley Road on a bicycle with a friend, and you could sit at the gate, there was a gate across the road to stop the animals coming down into Preston. And cars used the road, but they had to get out and open and shut the gate. And as a young lad, if you sat there and when a car came along you'd open the gate, they frequently give you a penny or two for opening the gate and shutting it for them. So if you hadn't got anything better to do, you go and earn a few pence.
Just go and sit there for days.
Yeah, well, you'd do 2 or 3 hours and then you go and spend whatever you'd earn in the sweet shop. But that was quite fun.
And sweet shops then in those days, so they must a different experience to buying sweets nowadays. I sort of think I'm of...
All the sweets are in... I remember... We had a sweet when we lived in by St John's Church, just at the bottom of the road there was Dench's sweet shop, and I remember 16 aniseed balls were a penny, and you could get a lot of, if you had a penny you could buy quite a lot of sweets, but all the sweets were loose and very few of them were covered, so if you got aniseed balls you'd have a great big glass jar and pour the aniseed balls out into a, there was scales with a metal dish on, and most things were done by weight, some things were done by numbers.
No, but that's I think that's probably the same sweet shop I can remember, actually. So yeah, just because St John's had got
there was the Waterloo pub
yeah.
on the right hand side and Dench's was on the other corner,
and that was it, and it was just like a shelf full of jars of different sweets, and you'd say
some of those and some of those and some of those, and going that in that street, because I went to St John's School, which was the state school just on the other side of the road, and you came out and you went straight into Dench's, but on occasions we had to go to, I can't remember why we were walking down there, I think they used a school hall or a hall down, because there was Tilly's, a garage down along there, but you went past all of the terraced houses and in a crocodile you had to be holding the hands of the child next to you, and if you went past the door and you, in those days they had knockers rather than bells, so you knock on the door, and frequently, you know, lady would come out and look at, extremely irritated at one of these children. She'd sort of hit the nearest child, had nothing to do with the knock on the door. So if you're at the front of the crocodile, you go bang bang, and then you launch back, and some poor child further back got a slap around the head for the problem that he caused. And you knew which houses had the most irritable ladies, so you'd try and choose those as well. And there were some irritable ladies.
Well, nothing. So nothing changes really, because you still see crocodiles of children going out for a walk, but they don't, knock and ring a bell. And
they probably still do it. I don't know.
So really, that's quite a lot. What lot of those businesses were still there when I was young then. Yeah. So that sweet shop was there. And Tilly's was there. The bike shop.
Well, the pubs stay forever, don't they? They seem to hold on. And Tilly's all went, and most of it's gone now. I think Benches has gone.
Yeah, that went away. Yeah. And St John's has gone.
It's now a block of flats or something. Mm. Although I think the school moved to Weymouth Bay Avenue, someone told me the other day. There was a Mrs. Tipper who ran it as our headmistress, and she was a. And ironically, when I went to Hardy's later, Mr. Tipper taught me physics at the Hardy's. And I think I got a slightly easier treatment than some of the other boys because his wife had spoken well of me when I was in my early days. But I got into awful trouble because I didn't like school at all. When I started, I'd been taken to the Convent of the Sacred Hearts by my sister. I only lasted one day there because I couldn't. I thought these nuns in habits very frightening. So I screamed all day, and my sister said she would never take me to school again. So the next day I was withdrawn from the Convent of the Sacred Hearts and sent to St. John. And I decided I wasn't going to like school, so I used to ask to go to the toilet, which was outside, and go straight out of the gate, cross the main road. And in those days, there were two main roads. The Dorchester Road going to Dorchester was a dual road, and the road to and from Preston was a dual road with the Victoria statue in the middle. And I think after the first two or three times, Mother made it clear I wasn't welcome at home when I was meant to be at school, and took me straight back to school. So I collected a few of my toys, and the next day when I left school, I stopped in the little trough around the Victoria statue and I started setting up my toys and playing there. And Mike Whittle, the florist, popped in and said, "Mrs. Light, I don't know if you know, but your son is sitting in the middle of a main road playing." And Mum came out and took me in, and she caned me. That's the only first and only time she ever caned me. But she gave me a real caning, and I never left school again. I think that was the last time I left school. So from then on, I settled down as a proper scholar.
But yeah, but you never really like, okay. So that's, okay, so that was two main roads. Okay. Yes. But it's interesting, yeah. So that
and there was a garage and a petrol station. The I think that it used to be a tyre, probably in your days a tyre. Mm,
yeah.
That was a petrol station in the days when the petrol pipes used to swing out over the road on a little gantry. It's made illegal now because if anything went wrong, the petrol fell on people walking past. But as a result, there were cars parked there. So if you imagine, the traffic was a lot less, but cars going both ways plus cars parked and pulling into the... Well, not pulling into, just you just stopped outside the petrol station and they poured petrol out of these pipes. And that was Shannon's as well, I think.
Right. You know, I would think, yeah, traffic was probably booming quite quickly in your childhood. It probably, yeah, it's like that real sense of change of people starting to buy
cars.
Yes, you
didn't recognise it at the time. Nearly all the cars were black and there were an awful lot of pre-war cars.
But as you got older, I'm just thinking, yeah, if it was 55, so yeah, 55, 60.
Yes, although there was no MOT. So there were a lot of pretty derelict cars still running on the road. I mean, if the tyre stayed up, it was acceptable. So a lot of the firstly, cars broke down a lot, so you frequently spent time fiddling around with cars. And from a very early day, I remember having to repair cars with my dad. He didn't have a car at all. When Grandpa died, he had a little bit of money, and I was about 13 or so, and he bought a Lagonda. That was a wonderful car with an Aston Martin engine, and cemented my enthusiasm for cars, which I never lost. But I'm afraid I wrote it off when I was 17, so but there we are, it's part of life.
Mm. Now, I remember for the Paul project, I interviewed a gentleman, and he'd got an insurance policy or payment or something, and he bought himself a car, and where he worked, there was only two cars in the car park. It was his and the managing director's. Mm. He was like an apprentice. And it was just like...
Well, it stood me in good stead, because when I got a job much later in life in London, I bought a car that was way above my status. I worked for an oil company. And it was causing so much... I used to park it where it could be seen. And they got so annoyed by it that I got a company car into my job much earlier than I would otherwise have done so, just to get rid of this fancy car so that I was back to a Ford Cortina or whatever it was that I should have had, you know, in the view of the rest of them. So then that was Dad's Lagonda who persuaded me to get myself a really fancy wire-wheeled Rover. So anyway.
So sailing, you just go out on your own or with friends? Yeah. Now, so who would you play with when you were going outside? I mean, there were just friends in the area.
School friends, because I was at St. John's School, so a lot of the school friends lived very, very close nearby in my early years. And when I went on to Thorn, though, and so I had friends all around the town. And by that time, certainly at sort of 8, 9, and 10, you were able to cycle off and meet friends and spend a day with them, and mum wouldn't worry as long as you were back. So they were nearly all friends and school friends. My mum was one of 11 children, and so we frequently had aunts, uncles and cousins, and as we lived by the seaside, they were very, very regular visitors, so there were lots of cousins coming to and fro. So it would either be someone I knew from school, okay, or someone from the sailing club, I suppose. Although from sailing, I used to crew for other people racing in Weymouth Bay, and there were lots of older people always short of a crew. So I'd spend a lot of time when I was sailing, crewing in races, going round and round the bay in old boats called Falcons, which used to be the sort of popular boat.
That's it. So that's it. You just go down to the sailing club and hang out, and then somebody says, "I'd need a crew," and
you do the first time. But once that's how you met your skipper, as it were. But as soon as you
met somebody you got on with,
then you'd sail with them every week. And indeed, I met a guy called Ravi Williams, Christopher Ravi Williams, who worked at County Hall in Dorchester, and he taught me most of my cruising sailing. He had a folk boat, and he was a bachelor. His entire interest was in sailing, very little interest in work, although he did it if he had to, or because he had to, I suppose. Mm. And we used to go sailing in this folk boat, no engine, and we'd sail across to the north coast of France and have holidays over there. It was really enjoyable. But again, I suppose mothers nowadays would be doubtful of a man taking two little boys off sailing and read all sorts of dodgy things into it. And in fact, he was one of the nicest. My son's called Barnaby Ryby. Indeed, one of my brothers, who also came sailing with me, he's just got a grandchild who's been called Ryby. So the name carries on. Mm-hmm. But he was a great mentor and a very nice gentleman.
So that's interesting when I asked you that question about friends, and because you're talking about a huge difference in age, and quite like a friend.
He was a friend. I mean, if you had a problem, Ryan would always talk to you about it and give you very sensible advice. And he's a friend. He became a friend of the family. I mean, he came around at Christmas, and because he lived with a very elderly mother in Cranford Avenue, he became a friend of the family. And I used to, when I was down in Greencourt, I used to go in on a Sunday to meet Angela Coleman, Angie as I knew her, who was an old lady who lived on her own and was very lonely, I think, really. And she was slightly, she was eccentric, let's put it that way. And the first time I went in there, she said, what do you like? And I said, she said, do you like anchovy sandwiches? And I said, yes, I like anchovy sandwiches. So I got an anchovy paste sandwich. And I went in there for 3 or 4 years, I suppose, on a Sunday to see Angie and make sure she was all right. And I just got stuck with these anchovy sandwiches. They came on and on and on until I couldn't stand them. But I didn't dare say, can we have something else? You know?
Yeah, so she said, that's what you like. Yeah, Nick. He likes those.
Yes, I do them specially for him. You know, I was thinking. Yeah. But once you got into that trap, you're trapped.
And the other interesting thing is, because talking to young people today, is how would you arrange to meet these friends? Like, so you have friends all over town. I mean,
we talked to them in school. That was probably why you didn't have the other methods of communication. We didn't have a telephone, so if you wanted to speak to somebody, you went and spoke to them, and go on your bike, and people were much happier in those days to just knock on someone's door and say, you know, is Julian in? Can we go out and play?
Mm.
And they didn't seem to worry at all about it. I think people nowadays like to organise meetings in advance and things because they can. But in those days, you couldn't. So if you felt like playing with somebody, you'd cycle around various friends until you found one that you could if you hadn't.
So you wouldn't arrange it at school. You would just go around and know there's a group of people in an area and you'd knock. And then somebody would say, oh, yeah.
Okay. Yes, you keep, and you frequently go, you know, I'd go and knock on Julian Oddie's door and say, fancy coming down to the harbour or something or other. And he'd have Chris Winstanley there, so Chris would come as well. And, you know, you'd end up with a tribe of kids wandering around doing something. And then someone say, oh, I've got to go home. And if there were still some others, you'd carry on with them. And if there weren't, in the end, you went home. And you didn't sort of do things. There was a lot of wandering around and you know, let's go and have a coffee or tea, or it depends what age you were, but certainly everyone had a bicycle. Transport was almost universally bicycles, and if you were out in, you know, certainly in the teenage years, you'd use the buses, but then there was a number 22 that went sort of from one end of Weymouth to the other every 20 minutes, I think it was, or every 10 minutes, and frequently, because the buses were open platform, you could hop on, and if the conductor was upstairs and he hadn't come down, you'd hop off again without paying. It was a much more free and easy approach, and he'd try and get as many of the passengers to pay as he could, but he wouldn't. As a child, I remember on occasions staying on the platform from one stop to the next and thinking, oh, he's coming down, and hop off at the next and then walk the rest of the way. But I'm afraid that was how children kept their pocket money a little bit longer.
Mm-hmm. That's when you could just hop on the bus when it was still moving and things.
Yes, and indeed it was fun to get off. It was fun to see how far before the bus stopped you could get off without falling over, because the thing would sort of progressively slow down. And it was quite a game to see how. And the same on the trains. The trains had open doors that you could open long before it got to the platform. And we went to school on the train in Dorchester when I went to Hardy's. And you could certainly, it was a challenge to see who was the first off the train. You know,
I've forgotten about those.
Yeah, they're quite fun. Yeah. With a leather strap that you pulled up, because you're all third class, and to open the door, you pulled the leather strap up and let the window slide down. Quite heavy windows, and then you can reach out and turn the handle to go.
That's right, yeah, because that's it. You had to the handles was outside, on the outside, so you always had to open the windows to get.
So later, some of them had a thing on the inside that you could slide across, there were quite a few that still you had to drop the window, and some of them didn't have any corridors either. There were two lots of, I don't suppose you remember those, but certainly because they gave all the old rolling stock to the school children, because generally the school children tried their hardest to demolish it.
So it was a special train.
You were only allowed, the school girls were allowed on the 8:20, and we were allowed on the 8:40. So I may have got the time slightly wrong, but certainly there was 20 minutes between. To try and separate the boys and the girls, you weren't allowed on the same train, and they tried to get it far enough apart that you weren't spending too long on the station together. But it meant you got to the station way before time in order to have a look at or chat to some of the girls on the green school train.
And the girls were going to Hardy's as well?
No, the girls were going to the green school in Dorchester, which was, as it was known, I think it was Dorchester Grammar School for Girls, and the boys were going to Hardy's. And they tried their hardest to keep us apart, and we tried our hardest to get together, so it was quite fun. Occasionally a girl would miss her train and then would have to get on the later train. And some of them missed their train quite deliberately, I think. But. And you could stop the train. Because we only learnt this. They were steam trains, and they were working somewhere near their limit with a whole lot of children on there going through the tunnel at the Ridgeway. And we found that if you all bounced in unison, the bouncing appeared to put a lot more pressure on the train, which was already struggling to get through the tunnel. So somewhere as you got to up on Broadway, I think, which was the little halt just before the tunnel, as it started out of there, you'd all bounce, and you'd have the monitors standing at the end, now, you'd get a bounce going, you'd feel the whole train sort of bouncing up and down on its springs, and it would grind to a halt. Whether the two were related or not, of course, no one ever knows, but if the train could be stopped, it was then jolly hard to start it, and it usually waited till the next train came up behind, and then the two of them would push, and it would get pushed out, so...
Oh, really?
But there was quite a little game to try and make your train stop. Didn't always stop, but... No, sometimes okay. It
did. Oh, that's for, yeah. Well, I wonder if that's. Well, I've never heard that one before, yeah.
No. I can't remember which locomotives. We knew the locomotives off by heart, and there were some that could get up, and the big Merchant Navy class could just pull you straight through, and you didn't even bother to start. But I think it was the Halls or something. Some of the less powerful trains that they put on the front, then you could influence how fast they went, even if you couldn't bring them to a halt. And occasionally they came to a halt. And we used to go into, in those days, they turned trains by hand in the railway sidings at Redipol. And if you went down to the sidings, they'd run these enormous locomotives onto a big roundabout thing with a bar at the end, and the fireman would just push on this bar and push the whole thing round. And as a child, you'd be allowed to push it round with him. And it was amazing to see this 60-ton locomotive just spinning round on this thing. It was really quite exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the fireman used to do that?
Yeah, the driver would drive it on, because it came, they had to go forward, the old steam trains, or the, I don't know, I presume they had to go forward, but so they'd be, they'd come into Weymouth, then they'd reverse into the sidings and go onto this railway. It'd be turned round. They'd then reverse back into the station onto the front of the train, and off they'd go, take it up, having filled up with water and coal. And so, and as a child, you weren't meant to be anywhere near there, but...
They didn't mind, they helped out.
If you were in there, they'd quietly let you get on with it, you know. Occasionally someone would shout at you. But you got to know which ones were the shouty ones and which ones were free and easy.
Okay. It must have been quite a busy, noisy station, really. Because the trains going round to the service, the ferry.
Lots of goods trains. And you don't have goods trains now, but there are lots of goods trains. And all the sidings where I think there's B&Q and all that lot along there. And that was all sidings where the shunting engines were shunting stuff to and fro. And they used to sort of shuffle wagons around to get different ones together so that a train would go back and stop and the last one would go shooting off and someone on a set of points would send that one into this siding and the next one into that siding. Because in those days, there were still trains going to Abbotsbury, so they were in the early days. So from Broadway they go round and off on the Abbotsbury line, although that was shut, I think, during the beaching crisis. There were still certainly trains going into the port, but there weren't any trains. They'd stopped the trains going to Portland, but the railway was still there. So, or parts of the railway certainly were still there. The bits that we used to walk along were still had rails and lines and things. And all that was... They took the bridge away first, because there was a bridge going, taking the railway across the Swannery. And then... slowly they took all the railway.
Okay, oh, that was nice. Oh, right, so you said you could still get a train to Abbotsbury. Oh, that'd be lovely.
Yes, to Abbotsbury. Yes, it was down the Abbotsbury line. Yes, that was fun. I didn't ever go on it, but it was at Broadway. You could see things in that siding there. So.
No, it's much. I mean, I sort of miss not having a train that goes up that way in the country.
Yeah.
So trains, and also like you were talking about, everybody had a bike. Makes me think, toys, what sorts of toys would you have?
Mostly wood and some, if you're lucky, metal. So there were dinky toys, matchbox toys, Meccano. I had a fort, lots of soldiers, lead soldiers.
So the fort would be bought, or...?
Yes, it's funny because we weren't very well off, and... I had this lovely great fort. Dad was in the army during the war, and he was in the TA, and he used to drive ducks. Do you remember ducks? They're a great big amphibious vehicle, and they were used a lot during the war, and they'd kept a few, and I know the Territorial Army used these ducks, and on Remembrance Day, you'd see Dad saluting in the front of one of these ducks driving along the seafront. He was a captain. And they had children's parties up at the Territorial Army. The Territorial Army had, you know, real Captain Mannering sort of effort, but lots of people thoroughly enjoying soldiering.
And where was that? Where were they based?
As you went through past the brewery, which was working in those days in Hope Square, and you went turned left up towards No Fort, which in those days was abandoned and a child's paradise, because you could get in there and have a wonderful time in the No Fort. But anyway, as you went along towards the No Fort, on the left hand side were the army barracks. And they had a wonderful, great, forget what you call it now, full of guns. And you could go in there, and a sergeant would, you know, let you hold a Sten gun and a Bren gun and all these sort of things. And you could go to the firing range, which was on the edge of Portland. And I never fired a gun because I think that was strictly not allowed. I did with the cadet force, but I didn't at when I went out with Dad. But I did remember a man who fired a. He had a pistol and he fired a bullet into a barrel and caught the bullet. And the water is so... unless you know what you're doing, I wouldn't recommend it, but certainly he fired this pistol into the barrel and caught the bullet, and that amazed me. And he said, well, you know, the power of water to stop a bullet is amazing. So though you feel you're being shot at, hide behind something full of water. early lesson in life. But we used to, yes, they had a... Christmas party. The army did a Christmas party with a present for all the children, and Father Christmas arrived and children's games and things. That was always quite a highlight of the year when I was.
It's interesting this period of time, because even though you say you're not very well off, that there's quite a few toys that you're mentioning there that previous generations would have not had. Wouldn't have been able to afford.
I think it was one of the advantages of being one of five children, because frequently your toys had been someone else's. Well, in fact, almost invariably. I don't remember many toys that were bought new. And there was a second-hand shop in Ranley Road, I remember, and I think a lot of my toys had arrived from there, and a lot of them ended up going back there. And indeed, I got a bicycle, and it was some months until I realised my Fort had disappeared shortly before Christmas when the bicycle arrived.
Because you hadn't been playing with it.
I hadn't been playing with it, and I suddenly said to Mum, "Where's my Fort?" and eventually got it out of her that they'd had to sell the Fort to buy the bike. So that's how, I think it was all done by, and Mum had a pile of bills on a corner of the desk, and Dad worked for the bank, so they weren't allowed to have an overdraft. In those days, the bank was able to tell you what you could and couldn't do, and one of them was that bank employees couldn't have an overdraft. And so the bills would sit in the corner, and I remember if anyone complained, they'd sort of say, you know, you'll go to the bottom of the pile, you know. But she paid off. Everything was paid, but it was just not always paid when it was meant to be paid, because it was paid when it could be paid.
Mm. So you shared the sort of toys that you were talking about, like lead shot soldiers would last. Yeah.
Oh yes,
a long time. Right. A Meccano.
Yeah.
So did you have a big Meccano set?
It accumulated. I started with a little set and bought other little bits and pieces. And as a child, you'd spend your pocket money in going buying a bit more Meccano. Or I had a train set, a Hornby 00 train. Oh, did I have Trying? No, I had Hornby and my best friend had Trying, but that way we all knew which was which. And they wouldn't run on each other's tracks. I remember that. They had different electrical systems. So.
Not different sizes, are they?
No, it's the same size. It was 00, but one had a centre rail or something. I can't remember the difference, but I do remember that the electrical pickup system was different on the two, so that you couldn't run one on t'other and t'other on one. And if you were really rich, you had some Swiss train set that had it picked up from the overhead continental style rail. All 12 volts. It wasn't going to do anyone any harm, but that was a Fleshman, I think it was. Yes, if you had a Fleshman set, then you clearly came from. And I only had one friend who had these fancy, and I think they were on a smaller gauge as well. But they're very, very beautiful models, but not really children. I think it was for adults, from the price of everything. So.
Mm. But that's what's interesting. I mean, well, one is because you playing, like say that, like the Weymouth Station being so busy and hectic,
yeah.
You can sort of see the appeal of train sets.
Oh yeah,
coming.
The two are related for sure. Mm. And particularly as you could buy the trains that you were seeing every day, the really good ones. And you got to know the class. I mean, Ian Allen did a series of train spotters books with all the numbers of all the trains, and indeed they had other ones with carriages and things, and diesel electric. But you hated the advent of diesel electric because it wasn't nearly as much fun getting the number off of diesel electric. And we used to go to Alexandra Bridge over the railway at Radipole and try and drop a stone down the funnel, which... strictly not allowed, but your chances of doing it was pretty slim, because as the train got close, all of a sudden you're enveloped in this cloud of smoke and couldn't see a thing, you know. And there was only a pebble, it wasn't a stone. I mean, never did.
No.
It wouldn't have broken a window or anything, but it was great fun.
Yeah, no, it still is. I think when the steam train comes to Weymouth, I think it still draws a huge crowd of people to come.
Yes, they had a... And when they started, they used to spin the wheels, because with a steam train, I don't think they had the control of traction that they have with a modern train, so that when they'd started, you'd hear sort of... And then all of a sudden the wheels would start spinning. Then he'd take the power off again, because he didn't want it to spin. And, you know, but it was lovely watching that. As a train spotter, you'd be up there and you'd suddenly see these wheels shuddering, because enormous tonnage on a very large wheel. You just felt that the power of the thing was very evident. You know, it had a life of its own, a steam train, in a funny sort of way.
No, I never thought about it being the traction knock. Like I say, you can picture it in old films, like the wheel spinning and it starting up.
But little things like that.
But that's it. But you can sort of you can sort of see that hive of activity and the openness that you could go in and be part of it, being how a train set would appeal and how the two would be related.
Yeah, so my friend had one. Having a train set was difficult because of the amount of space you wanted. People didn't have unlimited space. I had two friends who had very good train sets. Henry Parker had a train set and they lived in a bungalow and it went all around the angle bit in the eaves. So you'd have the bit you could see and then it would disappear off. And if it came off the tracks in the bit you couldn't see, you were into really quite a job to get across and get the train back and then put it back on the lines again. And this thing went all around his attic. And then Mike Derrick in Dorchester Road, he had a train set on pulleys in the kitchen and it was on a big board and you pull this set of pulleys and the thing would descend and you could play with the trains, and then when they wanted to have a meal or anything you had to pull it back up to the ceiling and you would be sitting under the train set having your meal. That was quite a good idea.
Because otherwise you'd have to put your train sets away every day.
It was considered pretty stupid if you had to put it all away and bring it all out, so everybody found some way of having it running under a sofa or you found somewhere where you could set it up and keep it, even if it was only for a couple of years. So a lot of buildings had garages with a loft above or something like this, so you could nearly always find somewhere where you could get it set up.
And Meccano, what sort of things would you build with the Meccano?
Mainly things, cranes and things that lifted. Anything that would... if you build a bridge that would span the bath, so you could have it in the bath when you're having a bath and things. Something that would do something. So the nice thing about Meccano is that you could make something that would hold a heavy weight or crane something up. So it wasn't like Lego where you sort of build tower. Well, I suppose Lego you can do the same, but it, to my mind it's more fun. You could make things that were very much stronger as well because you had screws and bolts and things. So once you knew what you were doing, you could make quite sort of strong things.
And would they be very big objects?
No, because you haven't got enough Meccano. They'd be as big as the Meccano you had would allow you to get. So frequently you take it to a friend's house and you put the two lots together. You can never sort it all out afterwards, and there are frequently arguments and that's my bit. Oh no, it's not, it's mine. But it was the only way to, you had to share, you had to learn to share in a way.
To build something, big.
Yeah.
Otherwise there'd be sort of smaller. Okay, you touched on the cadets. So did you take part in organised leisure activities?
Had to. School, everyone was in the cadet force.
So everybody at Hardy's?
Everyone at Hardy's was in the cadet. You could choose whether you were in the Army, the Air Force or the Navy, but you had to be in one or the other. I don't think we had any conscientious objectors that were allowed to. The regimental sergeant major would interview you about what you were doing. And he made it fairly clear that the option was one of three, not four. So I think you had to be an idiot to say that you didn't want to do it. I don't know what... No one ever got out of it in the period I was there. So that was quite fun.
Yeah, okay. So it wasn't... So not something you're choosing to do after school. It's something you're...
Oh, no, you had an afternoon. And it included, the guy would come along with his stick on... You had a parade. You started with a parade. So the previous evening you'd have had to dub in your webbing and black your boots and everything else, and it was fairly officiously run.
And that was once a week you'd have
once a week
cadet.
Yeah, and if this guy came along and he run his stick up the back of your hair and say light, that's too long, you didn't even question. You'd beat if come hell or high water, you'd get it cut the next week if you had to cut it yourself, because you never crossed the regimental sergeant major. And no one ever knew what would happen if you did, but he made it very clear that it wouldn't be fun, so you didn't.
Okay. All right. And you didn't do that, so that wasn't after school or...
No, that was during school. That was the afternoon. So that day you'd have to take... I think you went in your cadet corps uniform. And actually, I can't honestly remember if you... perhaps you took it. I don't remember. But you had to be in it, that's for sure.
And what sort of activities would you get up to in cadets then? Just drilling and
marching. A lot of drilling. They did all sorts of training. So you learnt. You had to pass your part one or part A and part B. I think it was part one, part two, perhaps. I know because my younger brother Paul, he became my sergeant at one stage, and it was a. I failed my part one. I was hopeless at the cadets. I didn't really like it. You'd spent all evening buffing up this uniform, and the next morning the first thing you were told was to crawl through some mud in it. You know, and he thought, well, this is ridiculous. You just spent all last night and. You had to do monkey crawl, if I remember right, and various other things across the ground. You had to learn how to do all these things. And you're given. Now and again, we did have one or two trips out to Sidling Ranges, and you learned to shoot old ancient 303s, bolt action, five round 303 guns. And we went out there one day, and you had army tea, which was the orangest tea I've ever drunk. It was horrendous, it was rather like tomato soup. And you were either in the butts, where you were sitting in a trough in front of the targets, waving little arrows at the point at which the last shot had gone through, or you were doing your shooting down at the other end. And I remember one day there was, near the butts, there was a corrugated iron shed where they used to make up the targets and things. And I think it was John Ross McKenzie had gone into the little butts cabin to have a pee. And he was there when they started the shooting, and a guy called Spud Dolby thought it would be great fun to put a shot through this corrugated iron shed, and he put one shot through, and there was this pow noise as it ricocheted in and out. And then someone else thought, oh, that's a good idea, and put another shot through, and all of a sudden we saw John Ross McKenzie with his trousers round his knee hurtling across a piece of open ground to jump back into the trench again. And the shooting was immediately stopped, and there was an investigation into it all. It was all horrendous, and no one was hurt. But it was could have been an awful accident.
It could have.
This is allowing children to play with guns, I think.
But anyone, adults as well, I'd imagine. I'm sure that went on.
Well, one of the games we used to play was you'd fire your round, and then the markers would mark it. And if you could possibly do so, you'd get the next round off before they brought the marker down and try and hit the marker. Because that would give them quite a shock if they're standing in the trench. But they're all, and boys shouldn't be allowed near guns, really, I don't think.
I agree, yeah. It's always a shock coming across them, like, say, at Buckingham Palace or somewhere. You walk around the corner and it seems to be like a 17-year-old with a...
Yes, it's frightening, isn't it?
Yeah, and there's somebody right in your own.
We used to have air guns. Again, you'd stand sort of 20 feet apart and try and fire between each other's legs. But the very worst you get is a really hard bruise from a old Webley air gun, but that was probably a lot safer. You could still lose an eye or something. So I'm very pleased that guns have been taken out of the equation largely in Britain now.
But what was that again? What sort of gun was that you used to fire between?
A Webley air gun. They were an air pistol, and to get the pressure up, you'd pull there's a little barrel that had the 0.22 or 0.177 slug in it, and to load it, you pulled the two apart, and it compressed a spring in a tube, then you shut it down with a pellet in it, and you could fire. And they'd kill a small mouse or a rat or something or other, but they wouldn't kill very much. And if it hit you, you didn't want it to hit you, but if it did hit you at sort of 15 or 20 feet, it might just graze you. But the very worst normally was a nasty bruise. So
it'd be like Dares, you'd all be standing there. Like William Tell.
That's right. Well, you had to stand with your legs apart, and you'd hope that he shot between your legs, then you shoot them. And again, if you shot on the road, the thing would ricochet off, and you weren't quite sure where it was going to go. So it was a silly thing to do, but boys will be silly, won't they?
They will be. No, that made me think of something, and I've completely forgot about it. Sort of things that you got up to at school in the break time. Can you remember what games you'd play?
No, I can't. As a very young, so we used to play hopscotch and things like that in St John's. But in the secondary school, you'd sort of sit around and talk. And we got up to mischief. They would play football and ball games. We're rugby, in fact, Northern football, because it was a rugby school. But you play football in the playground.
But rugby would be just part of a less like a sports lesson, really, rather than playing it.
Yes, you can't really. It's not much fun just wandering around throwing rugby balls. If you did, you'd just be throwing them at each other and catching them.
Just practicing,
Throwing it for fun. You could see if you could gets one on the back of the head if you could.
But it's interesting that divide between primary school and secondary school, that suddenly you sort of like you play these sort of games like hopscotch and bullfrog or whatever, and then it does seem even now that when you go to secondary school you just stop and it's more like you just hang around with friends and talking. And
it is completely different. I don't know why, but it was. We always had.
Was that peer pressure thing, like, you know, would it be seen as a young?
It's quite a shock when you go from because we all changed at 11 in those days, unless you went off to public school, which very few of my friends did. And you were sort of head boy, perhaps. I think I was head boy at Thorner when I was in the last year, and then all of a sudden you're an absolute, you know, oik at the next school, and you're just another name on the list. So you go from being someone quite important in your junior school to being another in the next school. So that's quite a psychological change.
A few people have mentioned that point, really, that. And they would, like, say head boy, and they're quite important.
Yeah, and then suddenly you're right down at the bottom. And I, in the first 2 years at Hardy's, whatever your height, and I was very tall, you had to wear short trousers, so I think it was about 5'9" or something. Rather wearing short trousers and being an absolute idiot, you know. I'm probably over remembering the height, but I remember I was taller than all. I was the tallest boy in the class, and you felt an absolute fool standing around in these short trousers. But that was you got over it.
The other thing that people have mentioned is making things like go karts to play with. Was that still part of them?
Yes. If you could get hold of an old pram or something, you could. You didn't have access to welding or anything like that, so it was mostly anything you could build with wooden screws. You had carpentry at school, so you began to see what you could do with woodwork. And we used to build things out of wood. I think we played more. We used to build boats. I remember trying to build boats that would float. Most of them sank, but.
Doing like little model boats type things.
Well, if you could try and make something you could float in and then take it down to the backwater and launch it and see if you could get across a piece of water or something like that. But it was awfully difficult to fill a plug in a bath. And it was very difficult to carry a bath because they're all cast iron baths. Mm. So finding something that you could... Oh, some of the galvanised... Yes, that's right. We did at Broadway use one of the big galvanised things that they used to use for washing, I think. We managed to make that float across a river.
Right.
It was quite... Yes, they're quite practical. Mm. I don't ever remember. What did we build? You used to take a sledge down the hills at in Coombe Valley Road. There's a nice hill there that hadn't got any fences. And when there was any snow, so we made up sledges when there was snow around.
Cricket bats, what about mate? Would you play cricket?
Yes, but you could always get hold of an old cricket bat, because again, there were lots of battered. I think most houses, things didn't get thrown away like they do nowadays. So you'd have a bag in the corner that had old tennis rackets and cricket bats and bits and pieces that had probably been around for 50 years.